going to be leading Living Word for us this week, Monday through Friday at 9 o'clock, and the title is Courage in Fearful Times, Letters and Lessons from the Christian Tradition. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you. Also, a word of thanks to all of you for coming this morning, to the folks who helped get me here, to friends and here and far. Thank you. As you just heard, I'm a professor at St. Olaf College. My name is Anthony Batiza. I've been teaching at St. Olaf for about 3-4 years now, within my fourth year. Before that, I was in grad school. Before that, I was a Lutheran pastor at a congregation out in Metro New York Synod. And before that, I went to the best Lutheran seminary, which was LSTC.
Okay.
I just made sure to do it all the best schools. it's a real treat to be here with you this morning. About myself a little bit more, you'll see my wife, Cynthia, and my two kids, Magdalene and Austin, running around at some point. Austin has a large stick, and he's 7, so just give him a wide berth. And he'll be okay. Magdalene will follow you anywhere, so for better or worse, engage them as you wish, and as you feel the strength. So this is my first time at home, so I'm excited to be here, but it's just kind of a new experience for me. Normally in a classroom, I have many, many weeks. And I have a captive audience who wants credits and all that good stuff. So it's sort of a different approach. And so let me tell you what I'm going to do this week. Each of the days in my Living Word sessions is going to touch on the Bible and ... something else. So there'll be some theologians, there'll be some literary figures, some social critics. They're going to pop up throughout the week. The days kind of build on each other. So we'll be doing some more groundwork stuff, some more historical, theological stuff the first couple of days, and more contemporary, last 50 years, literary stuff the last 3 days. But you can drop in and out as your schedule allows, as your hiking schedule allows, whatever's happening, and you'll be good sort of coming in and out. So don't be shy if you miss tomorrow. Please come back Wednesday or whatever your schedule is like. I'd love to see all your faces here every day, but just to let you know. So today I'm going to talk about... It's a little fuzzy. Okay. Today I'm talking about Thomas Aquinas on fear and how we're going to apply some of his understanding of how fear works, what fear is in human beings, to how we understand fear operating in some biblical passages, which is why I made you grab Bibles and lug them, those many books to your seats. Tomorrow we're going to shift forward a little bit, talk about fear and faith and courage in Thomas, but then go into the Reformation, go into Martin Luther, and apply some of those learnings to some New Testament lessons. Looking at some of Jesus' teachings on fear and faith, and some stuff that Paul says and the Johannine community say. Then Wednesday through Friday, I've selected a different African-American author from the last 50, 60, 70 years to get at some different aspects of what fear looks like and what courage looks like in the face of racism in America. So that will be sort of a background theme these first couple of days, and it'll become more to the fore in the last 3 days. Just to give you a sense, a little roadmap of where we're going. The reason I'm doing this, of course, is because it was assigned in some ways. They said, would you like to come teach? I'm like, sure. Like, here's the theme. All right, I will do that now. So they gave me the theme, and I decided to run with it. And the theme, of course, as you've heard probably from the directors and other folks, is fear not. Right? Taken from these passages in Isaiah 43, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. Do not fear, for I am with you. Okay. And I think one of the reasons why these passages I think resonate with a lot of folks, seem to be resonating in some of the people I've heard talk about it so far, is it conjures up this image, I think, of courage, right? Don't be afraid, God is with you. Right? God has your back, God is at your side, no matter how bad things look in the exile, how bad you are, fear not, God is with you. And I really like these images, right, that conjure up this sense of what it means to be brave and courageous, to not be afraid when things look rough, when the powers look strong, when the principalities are lined up against you. You know, put your arms on your hips, stand strong, and be courageous. Be a person who is not afraid. Unfortunately, that person isn't me. So, one of the early times my now wife and I's relationship, we were in Chicago at LSTC, the Lutheran School of Theology there, and we were just starting to date, and we went back to my apartment to hang out, and we were kind of hanging out, talking, whatever, and my wife looks away for a second, and all of a sudden she hears, ah! I something like that. That was me screaming because a moth had somehow followed us into the apartment, or found a way to the many holes in our apartments, and like it hit me right in the neck, right? So I screamed as loud as I could, started swinging at it. The moth kind of floated off away, up through the wall. My wife, then girlfriend, just kind of staring at me. All right, let's see how this relationship's going to go. Trying to see where the next 60 years are going to go. And so God bless her, she had courage and stuck with me. But the reason I was afraid of moths is because, for A, they're terrifying creatures. And B, because I hate insects and bugs and things. People are like, oh, there's bears here. I'm like, yeah, bears, that's fine. It's like, a swarm of moths is here. I'm like, I don't know. It makes my skin crawl, my hair stand up. They fly erratically. They're kind of like powdery. There's all these things about them. Just, can't take it. And so I have a real fear of moths and other insects. And I recognize it might not entirely be rational, but I'm not going to let it go. So I think we all have some of these experiences, right? Just these little things that you're afraid of that kind of freak you out. You can't fully explain it, can't fully understand it. It's just sort of a gut reaction or feeling. And sometimes we come across people who maybe don't have enough fear. You can see my low-res images here. I'm not paying for high-res stuff. Right? You have a little cat deciding to take on this eagle, right? This is probably going to end poorly for the eagle, and for the cat. Yeah. And the downside for the eagle is trying to digest the collar or something. That's the only problem the eagle has to worry about. Okay? So we can think, there's sometimes when people maybe, or creatures, should be a little more fearful. They should be a little more cautious. You should have more of that hair-raising sense in their gut that they need to sort of back off, mind their own business, and go pick on the dog for a little while. Okay? And I think we live in a time when we are faced with all kinds of sounds and images that for many people evoke fears, and sometimes we understand those fears, and sometimes we don't. So let me give you a couple of examples. The switch programs. No peace. No peace. No peace. No peace.
Doctor. Charged with additional crimes. Since you have refused to disperse, you will be placed under arrest.
No justice. No peace. No justice. No peace. Black lives matter.
I'm assuming you all recognize some of those sounds. What was going on there?
Protests.
Protests. What kind of protests?
Against police brutality.
Police brutality. Okay. What's the hashtag we use these days to refer to those kinds of protests organized by?
Black Lives Matter.
There you go. So, Black Lives Matter. We have lots of people, predominantly people of color, other folks, other allies out there as well, marching in the street, shutting down roads, interrupting speeches by politicians and entertainers, right? Taking attention. Forcing the people to pay attention to the question of police brutality and other various issues that they're raising. And for a lot of people, those sounds, those marches, those songs, those drums beating, those police sirens, all of that raises fear in them. Why is that? Why is this a fearful image to some? And why might those sounds be fearful?
It makes you uncomfortable.
Okay.
Violence.
Uncomfortable? Okay. Violence? What else?
Might have to give something up.
Give something up.
Make changes. Changes.
Changes.
Maybe also because it's an uncontrollable thing that they don't really can grasp what's happening.
So a lack of control.
Yeah.
Sort of chaos, the uncontrolledness of it arouses fear.
Or the backlash.
Backlash. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you mean by backlash there?
Well, maybe like white, how do you call them? Klux Klan and
white supremacists.
The right radicals.
So you're afraid there's fears about what's going to happen on the other side.
How this is going to work. White guy crashing into one of the demonstrations.
Yes, 1 year ago yesterday, give or take. Yeah. 1 year ago, 2 days ago. Charlottesville.
It forces me to say, where am I in this issue? Which is a process that I shouldn't do anyway, but this brings it to the fore.
Mm-hmm. And feeding off of that, is it personal? Are they angry at me because of this? Is it justified?
Worried about anger being directed at you because of the color of your skin, because of the institutions or whatever you participate in? Is that justified or not? And maybe not knowing the answer to all those questions.
Right.
Do another one.
We are what people, what family, and what glorious nation under God. And together, we will make America wealthy again. We will make America strong again. We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again.
Assuming folks recognize that voice. Who was that?
President Trump.
President Trump? Rally. At a rally in Duluth, Minnesota, a bit north from where I live. Okay. So for a lot of people, right, his voice and the voices at rallies, the voices of supporters, evokes fear. Why do you think that is?
Well, he might spy in the world wrong because
okay. Right. The constant fear that our good friend the Rocket Man or Iran or who knows Canada might get tired of all of this. Right? There's all these potential.
Or he might push the
atom bomb. Okay. Has the briefcase nearby. Okay. Others.
Fear of the hatred that is fueled and stoked by his words and what that hatred will and is leading to.
So fear about what this is going to do to those predominantly white guys there in the crowd, right?
Yeah.
We're cheering and getting all pumped up, chanting along.
No. They're afraid of change.
Change?
They're afraid of change. I deer hunt with a lot of these guys. I can't believe it. You know, I come from a small town, and I kind of live there for a while, but I go back, and it's like, it's a time warp.
So, what other kind of fears might you imagine these folks having? The folks in the crowd, the folks cheering, Trump himself.
Fear of loss.
Loss
of power, loss of influence.
So a real sense that their standing has somehow been diminished. They're not having economic opportunities, political access, right? So the litany of things that one might expect to hear, chatting with friends in the deer blind, or anywhere else you happen to know folks. Okay? Right, so there's just a lot of fears on all sides. Mm-hmm. And these fears can be particularly dangerous, obviously, for people of color, which would be my focus. I don't want to too easily or too quickly excuse or demonize the folks who support Trump. Let's be clear about that. And so I'm going to touch back on that at various times. But my main focus is going to be on people of color. And we'll bounce back and forth. All right. You all recognize this picture?
Yeah.
What was the meme that went with this? Anyone my younger?
Oh, or barbecue.
Barbecue, right?
Yeah,
this woman got the name Permit Patty, if I recall correctly. There were a bunch of memes that went around, just kind of her holding the phone. There was like an SNL skit of somebody walking through the background holding the phone, just sort of calling. Okay? But this gets at a recurring thing we've seen in the news the last 6 months, the last year. Not that it's happened only the last 6 months or last year, but it's been getting a lot of attention the last 6 months or year. Oftentimes, Caucasian women, of white women, in situations where they felt afraid or threatened by gatherings or activities of people of color, and have called the police to kind of come and break it up or help them or enforce either a vague law or an ambiguous rule. Right, or nothing at all, sort of just a perceived need that this needed to be stopped. And so fear motivated this woman, right, they would say, to make this call to the police, and a call to the police that might have ended very badly for those that family trying to have a barbecue on a Sunday afternoon. And we see this, of course, from the incidents that gave rise to the Black Lives Matter movement itself, the killing of Trayvon Martin in Florida. That when someone feels threatened, when someone is afraid of a black person or a black body or a brown person or a brown body, then that somehow legitimates any kind of action that they take. Right? I was afraid, I needed to protect myself, therefore anything that comes after that, any action I take, even lethal, is now justified because I was afraid. Okay? So
that's scary, this kind of law.
What's that?
For me, that was one of the most scary laws when I learned about it. So anybody who claims to be afraid of me can just shoot me down. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of silly. Or like, I mean, it's scary and it's crazy. Okay, but I'm not American, so maybe that's why I don't understand this.
Guess I'm not either then. No, go ahead, sorry.
I just don't understand how you can make a law like that, that if you claim you are scared, you can do anything you want to. It's just plain crazy.
You're right.
Okay.
Our Bishop Eaton of the ELCA was here last week.
I've seen her picture around.
Yeah.
my house.
And in one of her talks, she was referencing a group of high schoolers that she gathered together for some insight before the National Youth Convention.
Uh-huh.
And asked them what their greatest fears were, and their overwhelming comment was being shot in school.
Mm-hmm. School, yeah. Another issue with shooting.
Just being shot. And I thought, it really rocks my world because it makes me feel very helpless. Mm-hmm. And as an older generation leaving a world to these young people, I feel quite responsible for not doing a little bit better job. I mean, I know I'm only one person, but I can do something. So.
Yeah, the idea that it is more important to be able to protect your own life and even your own fear of your life, that allows and permits sort of the rampant gun culture. There actually was a recent case a month ago in Florida, where a white man shot an African American in a gas station parking lot. The sheriff decided not to prosecute or not to sort of arrest and arrest him for this, although the prosecutor still opened charges. Nevertheless, even the NRA said this might have gone a little bit too far. Which, when the NRA thinks it's gone too far, would pass too far 12 exits ago. This is the point at which the stand your ground laws, the sort of open gun culture, has proliferated to a point where even the gun defenders are getting even a little bit anxious. But again, it's all founded on this idea that you have a right to a weapon. And even deeper than that, you have a right to feel safe at all times. Mm. Anytime you don't feel safe, and you feel threatened, you can use any means at your disposal, whether that threat is reasonable or not.
But how is it going to work for the other person? Because, I always thought that your right should also, the right of another person is touched. And if you start waving a gun into someone's face just because he happens to be at a gas station, I imagine he or she might be scared. So that doesn't really work together.
Yeah, is it being whoever shoots first, I guess, is the winner there. If you both feel threatened, Yeah. Whoever pulls the trigger first, whoever is able to overpower the person, sort of a might man right at the end of the, end of the conflict. Again, not to condone that approach, but that, you're right, it leaves you with a conundrum. If everybody feels threatened, everybody is afraid, then apparently everybody has equal right to take the life of everyone around them, and now we have an interesting society. Yeah? All right. So, what I'm trying to do this week, then, is push us beyond just the maybe sort of platitudinous approach to being not afraid, to being courageous, and get us to think a little bit more deeply about what our fears actually look like in society today, and what we might have in our Christian tradition, in the Bible, to kind of help us think more deeply and more honestly about these fears that we're facing. Okay? So I'm going to shift a little bit. So I'm going to talk about fear and courage, mainly fear today, and I'm going to try and complicate the picture. Okay? We all have different, I think, personal and communal experiences with fear. I hope we get a chance to share those at some moment throughout the week. We're also going to look at a rich collection of biblical texts. They're going to present us with some more complicated images of fear besides just fear not. There are many texts that are going to tell you to be afraid and be very afraid, right? Particularly of God sometimes. So we're going to talk a bit about that and about how maybe it's okay to be afraid of other people in certain situations, in certain ways, and what does that look like for us? And then, as I said, we're going to be adding in a variety of theological and literary perspectives throughout the week. But tonight, I'm going today, not yet, it looks dark out, but it looks very dark in here. Today, this morning, yes, I'm going to do a heavy dose of Thomas Aquinas to kind of set the stage for the week. I hadn't realized this was like interfaith week, but I figured maybe a little Roman Catholic Lutheran dialogue. That works. Generally, a lot of Protestants, and particularly Lutherans, don't do much with Thomas Aquinas. I never heard him mentioned, I feel like, at LSTC. I'm not sure. Different classes than I did. not a lot of it. When I got to graduate school, my advisor was this Presbyterian Thomist, who was like this really oddball kind of thing. I was like, oh, this is different. So I got really into Thomas. So now you get to be into Thomas with me. For the long of the journey. So Thomas Aquinas, pictured here, looking probably more attractive and more expensive than he ever looked in his life. Thomas Aquinas lived in the 13th century, sort of a high Middle Ages thinker, 1225 to 1274. As I put it here, he came from this really wealthy Italian family, was one of the younger kids. So when you're wealthy and you have these, all these kids, some of them have to go off into intentional communities. There's not room for them, not a lot of jobs. So you send them far off to far-flung places to live in these strange intentional communities. Okay. Yes. And so the first community they sent Thomas to was a Benedictine community. And Thomas thought, this isn't hardcore enough for me. Right? They sent him to Michigan Luther camp or something. I have to go to Holden. So he thought the place I sent him wasn't tough enough, so he went to join the Dominicans. The Dominicans were particularly interesting. They were a brand new order at this time, kind of an up-and-coming order. So it's like joining this new sect kind of that's getting started, and it wasn't very prestigious because they were mendicants. So while every monk individually was poor, these mendicant orders were communally poor. So they didn't just have possessions or wealth themselves. They wanted to divest the entire order of wealth. And his parents were like, this is no way to help the family. Then, his brothers kidnapped him, tried to bring him back. He's like, no, I'm going back to Holden. And so he had this really interesting sort of path into scholarship and into ministry. And one of the things I really like about Thomas is that he tries to be the great synthesizer. Sometimes I have a picture I show my students of Thomas holding a big guitar, a synthesizer, and they don't get it. From the 80s. So Thomas is a great synthesizer. He tries to bring together a reading of the Bible, a reading of Scripture, with all of Christian theology. He tries to make sure he's read everybody and name drops wherever he can. But he also dips into non-Christian traditions. He wants to see what good is there, what can we draw out of the storehouse that we have from all these Greek philosophers who, sure, weren't Christian, but it turns out they actually said some good things occasionally. So let's use those things. He's also engaging Jewish and Muslim thinkers. All of these later things sort of got him into a little bit of trouble sometimes. And right after he died, there was actually condemnations against a lot of his teaching because folks were suspicious of it because he's using all these rabbis and all these Greek people. Thomas is a bit of a border crosser in his time. So, what does Thomas Aquinas have to say about fear? Well, first and foremost, Thomas places fear under the passions. And so what is a passion? Well, a passion is something that you experience in a way that makes you kind of an inactive patient or a passive recipient of what's happening to you. Something you sort of go through. Right? So it's not like your will. You're like, I decide, I choose, I go. All the verbs involved, like throwing and running and kicking balls and that kind of stuff. It's not that stuff. It's something that sort of happens to you. Something that you experience. And because of that, the traditions that Thomas was dipping into, the philosophical and theological traditions, really had a lot of trouble knowing what to do with the passions. With these things that just sort of happen to us, that roll over us, that we can feel in our splenna and our guts, just kind of making you all gurgly and weird. They didn't like any of that. They didn't know what to do with it. Particularly when it came to fear. So one school of thought, for example, the Epicureans, certain brands of hedonists, were particularly worried about fear. And the thing they were most worried about was the fear of death. So the Epicureans, for example, thought that most of our problems in life come because we are afraid of losing things. And particularly, we're afraid of losing our life. So to avoid that, they thought you should dip your life into as many pleasures as you can. This is where they get the idea of like hedonists having like great parties and all the good drugs and that kind of stuff. That's not what they were going for. What they were saying is that you should enjoy simply the pleasures that are harder to lose. So simple meals, well-cooked meals, a little bit of fish on Thursdays, a small community of friends kind of pulled away from the pull and the tussle and the challenges of society. Just try and keep your losses low by holding on just to a small collection of things that give you pleasure. And that will keep these fears away and also keep the fear of death away as much as possible. Right? Don't fear death. Death's going to come. Just try and eat, drink, and get merry in this life as much as you can. Yeah? That was one approach. Other schools of thought tended to think of the passions and of fear the way we might think of animals. So, many thought of passions like fear as an unbridled, uncontrollable animal, right? That's going to drag you this way or that, right? Much like this poor man being dragged by a horse. I'm assuming he's okay. I didn't do any Google searching to find out how he turned out from this fall, but you guys think he's walked it off. He's great. Okay? So the idea here is that fear is something that's going to drag you off and pull you in places you don't want to go and you shouldn't go. And the way you need to respond to that then is to train that yourself, right? To train yourself to control that passion, to control that fear. Just lock it down, get it in shape, beat it down over the years until it's like a racehorse. You can just ride it, right off into the sunset. Thomas tends towards the second approach, but with some interesting and important modifications. So Thomas, when he's thinking about fear, he's musing about it, he's reading these various sources, philosophers, theologians, Bible, all this stuff. He says that fear is probably best understood as our response to the possibility of loss. I think some of you hit on that when talking about fear earlier, right? This fear of change, this fear of loss, of losing things. So this is where fear comes from. Because we are mortal, contingent, bags walking about this earth for but a short time until we walk off this mortal coil, and then that's it. So because of that, we are often afraid of losing all kinds of things. And it's that possibility of loss, the fact that we can have things, even our own bodies, our minds, sort of taken from us over the years, that's where fear comes from. And to this, he adds some interesting comments that he draws from St. Augustine's understanding of love and fear, particularly in the Confessions. This is a passage where Augustine is reflecting on the death of a friend who was a good friend of his back in the town hall of Gast when he was a young man. And Augustine said, fear is born of love, since a person fears the loss of what one loves. And so here we see, right, in this understanding, that fear isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's sort of a natural response if you love something. Yesterday afternoon, I thought my daughter was, like, behind me, and she had, like, wandered off with my wife, apparently, but I wasn't paying attention. I was playing blackjack with my son. Different story. But and so I had this, like, oh, I'm sure she's fine. Right? And I was like, well, there's bears, there's moths, right? There's demon moths flying about, carrying her off, right? And so, you know, because I love her so much, sometimes her, like, unexplained absence or even small injuries, like a rug burn on her knee, seem to affect me in ways that seem disproportionate because I want to protect the thing that I love. I don't want to lose this thing that I love. And so I think this way of framing it makes fear seem, again, very natural, very important, very necessary. It's not a wild animal that's going to drag us off. It's not something to be avoided by minimizing potential losses in your life. It simply is what comes through love. So, Thomas further breaks this down and says that our fears of evil, which is the evil is the loss of something good, they come for a couple different reasons, a couple different ways. Fear sometimes comes based on the magnitude of the evil, the magnitude of the loss. So if I lose my coffee mug, you know, I like the mug a lot, but I think Amazon can buy me another one. I'll be all right, right? If I lose a limb, maybe a little more upset. If I lose my child, I can't imagine what that loss would feel like. Okay? So the magnitude of the evil, the size of the loss, affects the size of our fear. Thomas says that the reason we are often afraid is that these losses, this evil, is unwanted, which gets at what we said earlier, the sense of control, this loss of control. When we feel like we can't control our bodies, our people around us, keep control of the things we love, we get afraid. Fear rises up in us. And he says there's also the evils that are unforeseen. Not just moths in the darkness, but other things in the darkness. And how many of the folks at I'm going to pick on the Trump folks for 1 second. I wonder how many of the folks at a Trump rally, right, who are cheering build that wall or shouting horrible things about Mexican Americans, have actually had close relationships with Mexican Americans, or lived in among those folks, or been to the border communities, or those kinds of things. That often we're afraid of things that we don't even know anything about. And sometimes that lack of knowledge itself generates more and more fear, even leading, Thomas says, to anxiety. And we know what a terrible thing anxiety can be, what it can do to our lives, and it sort of becomes the dominant emotion that we feel. Okay. So what does Thomas say to all of this? Well, his solution is not to get rid of fear. As I've said several times, fear itself, for Thomas, is neither a good or a bad thing. It's just the thing that comes with being the kind of creature we are, the kind of thing that loves other things. But, so Thomas says that we shouldn't try to get rid of fear, that we shouldn't be fearless. Right? That's not actually the goal here. What would it mean to be fearless, based on what Thomas says about fear?
To not love anything.
Where is that at?
To not love anything.
Exactly. The only way to be truly fearless, Thomas would think, is to remove any love from your life. And then you would cease to live the kind of life you recognize as human. Mm-hmm. You would have some kind of condition on the spectrum towards sociopathy, mm-hmm. or something even darker than that. Right? Yes?
That's the other side of the coin of courage, isn't it? I think of stories about in battle, someone forfeits their life for their buddy. And now that's considered courage. But is that fearlessness?
This is tough. I'm going to talk more about courage tomorrow. And actually, Thomas flips the script a little bit. Most traditions focus on military examples of battle. He wants to shift it to think more about Christian ideas of courage, even though he thinks that that's a reasonable place to start thinking about soldiers and that kind of thing. But let's stay with the soldier's example. Right? A soldier charges into the field, right? Weapon in hand. Why?
Because he's told to.
Because he's told to, right? In which case, it's obedience, but maybe not courage. Mm-hmm. But maybe it is. Maybe he's tamped down his fears enough to overcome them or live with them and obey the command given to her by a superior. Maybe it's dancing with wolves, right? Mm-hmm. Where Kevin Costner is riding into the field in those opening, I haven't seen it in like 30 years. But he's riding out there on the horse, right? People think he's brave leading this charge and he's trying to get himself killed. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's ignorance.
Anger.
Yeah, so Thomas's insight here, his thought here, is you actually can't tell a lot sometimes by just looking at action, just looking at what somebody does. You have to really break it down and try and figure out, well, why are they doing it? Yeah. What's their motivation? What's the end they're trying to achieve? Why are they trying to achieve that end and not some other? Why are they doing it in these ways, in these circumstances, in these times, in these places? That when you start cutting more closely, doing a more fine-grained analysis, you're going to need to be a lot more careful about what you call courage and what you call daring, which is sort of the fearless idiot.
Yeah.
Right? So, if you've ever been told to be fearless, to live without fear, if you have maybe some sort of stoic uncle in your family who chastised you for being afraid of things as a small child, I know I had one of those. Right, I'm still afraid of moths. Take that. Right, then Thomas would say that to a person to shut their mouth. Right, that you're supposed to be afraid, and that it's only because you love things that you have these fears. Okay, but that doesn't mean that all of our fears are right. Okay? This is where Thomas gets a little more tricky. Okay? He thinks that our fearing can be both mistaken and misshapen. Depending on what we're responding to. Right? So if there's no actual... Is that a sound?
Water.
Oh, that's a saw coming for us. It's in the horror movie. It was spooky up in the woods.
Mothra's on the way.
Mothra, yes. Well, I brought repellent. Alright, so there could be no actual threat, like just a random sound. There's nothing actually out there to be afraid of. And so that's one of those situations where we've misperceived what's happening. Right? Like Permit Patty in the park. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was this group of African American people, and that made her fearful. Right? Presumably because, again, I'm just projecting, I don't know the woman, I don't know the details. But something about large collections of African Americans, African American men, tends to cause fear in white people. Studies have shown this, psychologists have shown this, television, radio, the news, all of these things, you just can't help it. Louis C.K., this comedian who's done some terrible things, but also had some interesting poignant comments on race occasionally, has this little bit where he says that he's the kind of racist who he'll be sitting in a gas station and there'll be a black person walking by and he'll think to himself, I didn't lock my door. Right? I feel good about myself. Recognizing that the fact that he thinks that he didn't do that is a good thing is actually a racist thing in and of itself.
Yeah.
Right? But that he had this desire to lock the door because a black man was walking by. Mm-hmm. And then pat himself on the back for not locking the door. So again, we can perceive threats that aren't really there. There's no challenge, there's no risk, nobody's taken our stuff, nobody's stealing your jobs, right? The threat isn't real. You've been lied to, or lied to yourself. Sometimes we can fear when we shouldn't, or in ways that we shouldn't, when the loss is actually not that great or important, right? If my coffee mug goes missing, and you find me laying on the ground tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, right, just beating the rock and tearing my clothes, I say, you might tone that down a couple notches. Right. You should go send the session out to Anthony and sit under a tree. Thomas also thinks it's wrong for us to fear losses of things that are actually evil or not good for us. Now, this gets at, interestingly, some of the stuff folks were saying about the Black Lives Matter, maybe over here, the fear of loss of white Americans, about what happens if black and brown folks get certain opportunities, get access to certain services, get places in government, become president, all that kind of stuff. There is a desire to not lose something that you probably shouldn't have in the first place. Right? Control of the means of production and the lives of billions. Right? That this perhaps is an injustice, and that you shouldn't be afraid when you've been stripped of injustice or been removed from injustice. Thomas would say, you know, I understand that you're afraid, but you're being made better. Finally, Thomas thinks, again, the threats can be genuine, but our fears can still become excessive. Right? We can sort of get trapped in them and exaggerate them, and they can grow and grow. Right? So even though I'm afraid that my daughter might be carried off by moths, right, or more likely bears around here, and I've heard there's like moms and cubs that keep hearing about, I'm like, oh, I don't know about that. Right, so those are real fears. But if based on those fears, if I locked her in our chalet room and said, I'll slide you some of that delicious bread in the door a few times a day, and we're going to get on the boat on Saturday, right? My fears are genuine, but there are threats. I've got to be careful. Can't stuff our pockets with bacon when we go for a hike, right? But at the same time, I can't be so afraid and so terrified that I don't let her live and move and enjoy the space and the community. So, how do we learn to fear rightly? Well, here's where Thomas brings in the language of virtue. So, crash course on virtue. A virtue is simply a good habit for Thomas and a lot of thinkers. It's a habit, meaning it's something that's inside of you. It moves you to act. It's stable, it's durable, it lasts over time, like riding a bike. Okay? Something you hold on to, and it generates good actions, good responses in you. How do you get virtues? You practice. And you practice by living with and around a community of exemplars, be they in books, be they in flesh and blood. And this is because of the kind of creatures that we are, Thomas thinks. Thomas is really amazed at the way that humans are sort of open to all kinds of possibilities. Right? So he says, if you look at a swallow, one of these birds, it can do like seven things. Right? I'm paraphrasing here. But like swallow, can do like seven things. It swoops, it grabs some bugs, it makes a little nest, lays some eggs, it moves on. So the kinds of things that a swallow needs to master are complicated and difficult, but it's a limited set. Humans, he thinks, boy, look at us. We have so many opportunities, so many different ways that we can live our lives, so many different actions we can choose, places we can go, things we can do. All of this, he thinks, requires a lot more training, a lot more work, and this is the kind of training work that virtue does. And so courage, then, is the counter to fear. It trains our passions, like that horse being trained, not to go away, not to be fully under our control ever, but to help us respond to and understand where our fears are coming from, to think about them, to sort of critically engage them, and ask, should I be more or less afraid? People I'm looking at and I admire, what kind of fear are they trying to inculcate in me? Is it good fear? Right, like being nervous about, police officers in certain situations? Or is it bad fear? Right, be nervous around all white people all the time. Right, there are some of those fears could be justified, some of them not. So, to close our time out today, the last 15 minutes I have, we're gonna look at a couple of biblical passages. And ask some questions about how fear is working in the text. What is this passage? What is this verse? What is this text trying to teach us about what fear means? Okay? So, for each of these passages, I have four questions, and they're the same for all the passages. So we'll take, how much should I get through all of these, actually? So, I'll do the first two. I'm going to do two. So we're going to begin with the theme passage. Right, the passage that we have here holding this summer, this Isaiah 43, 1-7. And I want us to do this in little groups. So if you could please, I know this isn't the greatest space, but kind of move your chair and or your body, whichever seems easier to move for you. Get together with like three or four folks, no more than four. more than two pyramids, or three or four. I want you to answer these four questions looking at Isaiah 43, 1 to 7. So who or what is being feared? There's a lot of talk and fear in the passage. What are people afraid of here? Why is there this fear? Right? Where is this fear coming from? What's going to be lost? Okay. Is fear appropriate in this text? So is this text saying it's okay to be afraid or not? Why or why not? And finally, do you experience this kind of fear in your own lives? Right, the kinds of things the text talking about, the kinds of losses, the kinds of evils that are being mentioned. Make sense? All right, turn to your neighbors. And I'll draw us back together in about 7 or 8 or 7 minutes.